So our sermon title this morning is Telling Stories. And that has a particular significance and a particular relevance for this psalm and what it is we're being asked to do, what it is that is the takeaway of this psalm. But first, I want to expand a little bit on the lectionary reading and talk about the movement of this larger psalm, some of which we didn't get to read this morning. So this psalm really has four specific movements to it. The first one is the story we read. It's being lost in the desert. And then if you move to verses 10 to 16, which we didn't read, but I invite you to read sometime this week in your private devotional time, there's a story about being prisoners. And then verses 17 through 22, there's a story about being ill. And then in verses 23 through 32, there's a story about being in a storm at sea. And we really only heard about the first event this morning, the event of God's deliverance to those lost in the desert. So each of these four stories or four examples in the psalm are actually set up by the same formula, by the same structure or mini-narrative, if you will. And it starts by describing the event. So what is the event? Well, being lost, being prisoners, being ill, or being in a storm. And then the next thing that happens in the psalm is the people cry out for help. And then the next thing that happens in the psalm is that God delivers them. And finally, each of these episodes concludes with a reminder to thank God for God's goodness and to offer thanks for God's steadfast love and wonderful works. The whole psalm, all 43 verses, are set up in exactly this way with our four examples and many narratives. And I think that this is a case of teaching people in this oral tradition, this was a case of teaching people by repetition, particularly when you're going through a rough spot. Because how many of us have been through a rough spot and maybe we don't feel like God is there or a community is there, and we need kind of the hall of faith. We need the people of faith in our lives to remind us of God's goodness when it feels far away or far removed. So this psalm, I think, was a case of teaching by repetition. People encounter trouble. They cry out. God delivers them. And God delivers them because of God's steadfast love. And the people experience gratitude for what God has done, and they respond with thanksgiving and praise. And as I look at this psalm and the flow of this psalm and the narrative structure of this psalm, I can't help but think about some of the messaging that we get in our kind of Western American society about getting into trouble and what happens when we're in trouble and whose responsibility it is to do what when we're in trouble. And it seems to me that the message we predominantly get, or the one that we get most often, is I can do it on my own. Some version of I can do it on my own. Or some version of you should be able to do it on your own. And I have to, in thinking about that, think about this idea that Western individualism, at least in its most extreme form, is really, it's not a Christian construct. And the systems that have given rise, political, economic, social, all of these things, are not necessarily Christian constructs. Now, I'm not saying that we can't choose to be Christians inside our political system, our economic system, our social system, or any other system in the world, for that matter, because we most certainly can, and we are. I'm just saying that it's helpful to engage in the practice of thoughtful critique when we see narratives and when we see what's happening in the world around us, to think about the messaging that we absorb and we hear all the time. Western individualism, as I understand it, really has historical roots coming from a couple different places, but it was certainly popularized in the mid-1800s by thinkers like Ralph Waldo Emerson, who penned the wildly influential essay, Self-Reliance. And before I kind of make him my talking point this morning, I have to admit I have read this. I've read Self-Reliance actually many times, and I like it a great deal, and it's a beautiful piece of literature, and you all, I would commend it to you. So I don't really have anything against Ralph Waldo Emerson or this particular piece of literature, and I think there's a lot of good fruit in it, but taken to its extreme, he is my talking point this morning. So his premise is basically that we should trust our own wisdom and try to become self-sufficient. The gospel of self-sufficiency is really what we hear kind of preached all throughout American quarters today. This notion that everyone should fend for themselves, that we're all responsible for shoring up all the resources we'll ever need, to the victor goes the spoils, in its greatest extreme, social Darwinism, etc., etc. Self-reliance, in many cases, places an over-reliance on human ability to solve our own problems. The Psalms and the writers of the Psalms really don't have a really super positive view of excessive self-reliance, and that word excessive is important. When we see self-reliance invoked in the Psalms or by the writers of the Psalms, we often see the proud, the rich, the arrogant, those who are kind of doing their own thing, trying to live and function in community and trying to faithfully discern God's will and learn what it is and what it means to do God's thing is really the goal of our community, to cooperate, to collaborate with God. Total self-sufficiency, total self-independence is both a fallacy and an excess that is roundly critiqued by the various writers of our sacred text. And in my mind, when I think of total self-sufficiency, total self-reliance, I think of like, how many of you have seen those shows on, I don't know if it's the Discovery Channel or TLC, but it's the it's like the apocalypse people who gather up all their resources and build their little bunkers and live underground with like five other people waiting for it all to go down. Has anyone else seen those shows? Know what I'm talking about? I forget what they're called. Like the end times people who essentially like try to gather up all the resources that they will ever need and kind of cut themselves away from society kind of in any capacity to be completely self-reliant. And that's really not compatible with a Christian sensibility. In the Psalms, and in this specific psalm, part of the point of the psalm is that we encounter circumstances that are bigger than we are, that are bigger than we can fix, and that we find the humility to call out for help, for God's help specifically, but for the help of a community to come around us and support us. And this is a really important lesson because asking for help is really hard for most people, right? Including me. I get embarrassed sometimes when I have to ask for help. Like, and I know that some of my relatives get embarrassed sometimes when they have to ask for help. As relatives and family members of mine age, mobility starts to wane, and maybe they don't have the strength and the energy in their 60s and 70s that they did in their 30s and 40s when they were young pups with all their muscles and all their good health. And so I, in particular, had relatives, and I didn't really understand this until I got older, who would just opt out of events if the event challenged their mobility. I had a grandmother who, if I would invite her to do something and it was sort of beyond her capacity walking-wise, she would just sort of make a kind excuse as to why she couldn't come. And it took me 5 or 10 years into adulthood to realize, oh, she really does want to spend time with me, but she can't do what I'm asking of her. She doesn't want to go hiking for 3 miles at the Glen Helen because she has a walker and there's 80 steps down into the glen. And compassion came over me when I realized, but she would like to meet me at Young's Dairy, or she would like to go down to the Second Street Market and have lunch with me. And it was on me to realize that she needed help. This is kind of universally a human, compassionate thing that we struggle to ask for help. And for me, part of me thinks, oh gosh, I'm not broke. You know, I'm not broken in any way. I should be able to do this thing. And for me, where this has come up in my life a lot is with moves, with my own moves. In my 20s, I could lift stuff and I could move stuff, and now I'll throw my back out if I try to lift a piece of furniture. And so there's a part of me that thinks, I make decent money. I could just pay a professional to come move my house or send some money to my friends when they're moving. But I'm richer and better for social connections woven throughout the fabric of my life. For these moments, however small and inconsequential they might seem, where I'm put into contact with some sort of natural barrier or some sort of natural limitation on my life, and I have to reach out and ask for help. The truth is that most of my ask for help problems are like first world problems. I moved a dining room set that I had bought online, and I rented a truck by myself, and then quickly realized I wasn't going to be able to lift the dining room table and the chairs and the hutch that I bought from this lovely elderly couple that was moving, and I had to ask for help, and I had to scurry last minute when I saw that I had overestimated my ability to move, and three or four people came out of the woodworks, and they helped. This, again, is a very first world problem. For many people, the problems are famine and job loss and illness. A few things happen when we have to ask for help. It changes us. In the act of being brought into some natural limitation, our human pride, our arrogance, our own sense of immortality have to fall away. I think in the act of receiving help, we also become a little bit more humble. And we become a more charitable version of ourselves. We become better people. I think we become, on the receiving end of help, people who are at the ready and a little bit more willing to offer help, to extend a hand to others. And we see this movement four times over in this very psalm. There's an internal realization of trouble, a collective cry for help, and then God intervening to help. And then we're called to express gratitude for God's help. And in all of this, we're pulled outside of our own self in these little worlds that we construct and into community and into relationship, perhaps even into relationship with some others who need help. Certainly into relationship with God, who is doing the helping. But in other instances, maybe also into relationships with others who are helping in some way, shape, or form, even as God is the ultimate helper. Our psalm for today invites those who have experienced God's help to offer thanksgiving and worship with a group of people. So not just to help, but to come and gather in a group like this and to offer thanksgiving and worship, to sing hymns and say prayers of thanksgiving. We are the hungry and the thirsty who have been fed. We are the bound who have been liberated. We are the sinners deserving death who have been given life. We are the fearful before the terrors of existence who have been given hope. As we think of modern philosophies or philosophers, again, I don't want to make Emerson my fall guy, and I don't want to poo-poo everything he has to say. He was quite a brilliant man and a brilliant thinker, and I've read Self-Reliance many times over, and there are some nuggets of wisdom to be found in there about trusting ourselves and trusting our own inner resources and coming into your own power and amassing some level of independence where you feel free to critique groups, organized religious groups, societal groups at large from the vantage point of your journey. But any idea in its extreme or in excess becomes a harmful idea. Total reliance on any system, any particular preacher, any particular government figure, any sort of power group is problematic, but total independence is just as unhealthy. And I think in the Western society in which we all live, we could all stand to hear the message that interdependence is the ideal for which we should strive, rather than the fallacy or the myth of total self-reliance or total independence. So why can we even trust God? Why trust God? Why take the risk of trusting God? Well, this goes back to the nature of God's character. The heart of God, if you will, is found in the idea of God's steadfast love, which is repeated as a phrase throughout this psalm a couple of times. And not just this idea of God's steadfast love, but the promise, God's steadfast love endures forever. So much love in our lives and in society is temporal and time-bound that it does not endure forever, but God's steadfast love endures forever. So the Hebrew word being used here is chesed. And chesed is the word expressing God's fundamental covenant relationship to Israel. Its meaning is really difficult to adequately express in English, and thus we see different English Bibles using different translations for this particular word in different translations in different contexts. So we might see it in the Bible phrased as steadfast love, or loving kindness, or just love in general, or kindness in general, or mercy in general, or loyalty, or favor, or devotion, or goodness, and there are others. But the assurance in verse 1 is that this quality of God, this steadfast love, is eternal. God will never abandon Israel. Never. God will never abandon us. Never. And the rest of the psalm elaborates and opens up that beautiful claim. And it's not just this psalm, by the way. Anytime the faithful of God are telling their stories of deliverance from exile, of hard times, of illness, of famine, or whatever it is that they're contending with, this word chesed gets invoked for God all throughout the Old Testament. In the midst of their memories, in the midst of their storytelling, in the midst of their struggle and their trial, in the changing seasons of their life, God's chesed is eternal. It's unchanging, it's constant, it's steadfast. It's the truest truth in their lives. Sometimes we see this word chesed in non-theological contexts, and so, or in context that humans are trying to interact with each other. For example, in the story of David and Jonathan, when they made a covenant to one another, sealing their friendship in 1 Samuel 18, Jonathan asked David to remember him and his family no matter what the future might bring, saying that if I'm still alive, show me the faithful love, the chesed of the Lord. Never cut off your faithful love from my house. So the meaning of chesed in this context is a loyal love between two friends who have made a formal pledge through a covenant. And it's also part of the vocabulary for describing the loyal love between two parties in a marriage. So we see this in Jeremiah, we see it in Hosea as the word steadfast love. In Jeremiah, we see it as the word devotion. So the word chesed is when you think of the deepest commitments, the deepest covenants, the most powerful bond of unbreakable, steadfast, enduring love, that's where this word gets invoked. Chesed is found to describe God's love for us all throughout the Old Testament, and in some cases, covenantal love between humans in the most enduring and eternal fashion. Now, for those of us who have been around the church for a while, we may be more familiar with a Greek word, and the Greek word is agape. How many of us know that word? Right. That all-loving, all-encompassing love flowing from God down to us, chesed is like that. This is a good reminder for us to have in a world where invariably things can and will and do go wrong in our lives that are bigger than we are. This is a good reminder for us to have in a world that's being turned topsy-turvy by political turmoil, our current election cycle, by mass shootings that have happened here, that have come close to home for us. This is a good reminder to have on good days and bad days, that God's love for us is eternal. God's love for us is not predicated on our self-reliance or self-sufficiency or our worth. God's love is chesed. We get into trouble, we cry out for help. God comes to our aid, God brings us through, and then we are grateful to God. God's love is chesed.